Hello and welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast from SUT, the Society for Underwater Technology. My name is Steve Hall, I'm the CEO, and each week we'll be bringing you interviews with our members and friends on a broad range of underwater subjects, including diving, offshore oil and gas, renewable energy, oceanography, robotics, history, marine archaeology, aquaculture, ocean policy, and much, much more. On 22nd of May 2020, it's the bank holiday weekend in the UK, so we're bringing you an extra episode, which is an interview with Mark Beattie Edwards, who's CEO of the Nautical Archaeology Society. He's been interviewed by my good friend Sue John, who's chair of the SUT Education Committee and an elected member of our SUT Governing Council. Mark will be talking about the wreck of the London, a very rare Cromwell-era warship to be found in two or more pieces in the Thames Estuary. Over to you, Sue and Mark.
Hello, and welcome to the Underwater Technology Podcast. Today I'm talking to Mark Beattie Edwards, who has got a very interesting project on the line. Mark, would you like to tell our listeners what it's all about?
Hello, Sue. Thanks for having me. Yes, so I work for the Nautical Archaeology Society in Portsmouth, in England. So we are a charity whose mission is to protect and preserve our nautical heritage, not just underwater, but also on the coastline, on the foreshore. And for many years now, we've run educational program. We've run our research projects and we publish an academic journal. And since 2016, I've been involved in one form or another with working on one of the UK's protected shipwrecks, which is actually in the Thames Estuary. It's called the London. She blew up in 1665. And I first got involved in 2016 as just a diver. I was one of the diving archaeologists that was asked to, contracted to come and help out on a team that was excavating it with funding from Historic England. And things have kind of spiraled from there, really.
So how did you find out about this wreck initially?
Well, I wasn't intimately involved in its rediscovery and the early phases of it. It was actually found. Well, in fact, it was never really lost. It was refound and re-came to prominence as a result of dredging operations, channel works in the Thames Estuary that were being undertaken in advance of the development of the Port of London Gateway by DP World, which is Dubai Ports. DP World UK, so their new gateway on the northern side, quite near to Tilbury Port, actually. And the Port of London Authority were going to be needing to dredge the channel to widen it in a number of places as well to allow for the larger vessels coming in. And as part of that development process, archaeologists or an archaeological watching brief is required to be undertaken. And Wessex Archaeology got that job, so they got that contract to do that for DP World and for the Port of London Authority. And they identified, 30 or so anomalies that were of heritage interest, including known and unknown wrecks and even aircraft. And one of them that kind of re-came to prominence was this site called the London. And I say it never really needed rediscovering because actually the wreck was already charted. It just wasn't 100% certain that that was the London. And in fact, soon after sinking, many of the guns, maybe even up to sort of 24, were salvaged soon after the shipwreck. The ship sank in 1665. So I kind of heard about it on the grapevine and then obviously through the internet and press releases, etc. It would, I suppose, during that commercial process back in the early 2000s, it would have been very much commercially sensitive and secret. But eventually, public statements and announcements were made, and you know that it started to appear on the press and on the internet. And so I would just like anyone else, really, I was just kind of following along with the project as a third party, as an interested party. And it was only when in 2016, as part of an excavation that was being funded, very small excavation that was being funded by Historic England, I got an email saying, was I free for a couple of weeks? Could I be loaned out or, you know, contracted by the NAS to go and become one of the divers on it? And it was great. And so from there, I've kind of got more and more involved.
Yeah, it's a really good project because this ship is kind of special as well. There's not many examples of this ship, is there?
Certainly, if we look at its history, then actually it's ordered and built during a very interesting time for us in the UK or in England in terms of our political history. It was actually ordered for Parliament after the Civil War from Cromwell. So it's Cromwellian. Is that the right word? Cromwellian. Yes, Cromwellian. It's Cromwellian, really. However, upon Cromwell's death, and then with the after the interregnum, when we don't have royalty, and then when Charles II is restored to the throne and brought back from the Netherlands and restored to the throne in 1660, the London is part of that fleet that brings Charles and his brother back. Now, we know that Charles himself didn't actually travel on the London. He actually traveled on the Naseby, which was renamed the Royal Charles. Charles liked to. He was actually quite a big fan of the Navy, quite a big supporter of the Navy, and certainly liked to name things after himself. And so it's named the Royal Charles after, because keeping the name Naseby wouldn't be very good, because that was Battle of the Naseby was one of the parliamentarian victories, so they definitely wouldn't have wanted to keep that name. But anyway, the London actually carries Charles's brother, who then later on becomes King James upon Charles's death. So there's a definite strong royal connection. It's quite interesting that it spans this the interregnum period, and then into obviously the royal back in the royal period with the Stuarts taking the throne, the ship itself doesn't see much active service, I have to say, but she was being prepared for the Second Anglo-Dutch War, which had been declared by the Netherlands in the very early part of March of 1665. So from February of 1665, she's being prepared to act as a flagship for Admiral Sir John Lawson to take part in the Second Anglo-Dutch War. But obviously doesn't make it, because on the 7th of March of 1665, before seeing any action, whilst out in the Thames Estuary, having come out of Chatham and being partly loaded up, partly, as far as we know, partly not having everything on board, the whole complement of crew weren't on board. Many of the officers were not on board. The Admiral certainly wasn't on board yet. She just blows up. And we have, in all honesty, hand on heart, we have no real knowledge of why, 100% why she blew up. But she would have had an inordinate amount of gunpowder on her, ready for war. And, I've had a colleague who've estimated that somewhere around about loosely the same amount of explosives or gunpowder that gets used for the fireworks in London on New Year's Eve is about what our shipwreck, the London, would have had on her. And that would have been a very large explosion, and over 300 people died.
And quite spectacular if you'd seen it from shore.
Oh yeah, wow. I imagine that the noise would have travelled an incredible amount. And you would have been able to see it from shore on both sides, whether from the Kent side to the south or the Essex side to the north. They would have been able to see the ship explode. We don't know what time of day it exploded, so we don't know whether it's a daytime, nighttime, and dusk kind of explosion. But what we do know is that the two known parts so far, anyway, and there could be more, the two known parts of the ship are 400 meters apart. So it certainly would have been very dramatic. The noise would have been heard for many, many, many miles around. I suspect people would have just stopped, paused, and wondered what that very large bang was. Or maybe if it was, if they were asleep, they'd have been woken up by it.
Very definitely, because I've seen some of the artifacts that have been found. Now, it's also very well, the artifacts themselves, the shoes, the pipes, and the general stuff that people have with them on board ships, have been perfectly preserved because of the type of mud that it's sunk in.
Yes, its location, where it is now, where it sank, is both a blessing and a curse, really. It's a blessing because if we think about it, had this exploded off of the Scilly Isles, off of St. Mary's in the Scilly Isles, then just the natural topography underwater, the geology, you know, the fact there isn't thick mud, there isn't clay, you've got rugged, rocky, you know, coastlines and seabeds, would have meant that actually most of it would have been destroyed very quickly by just Mother Nature. And heavy material like guns would have all been found relatively easily and salvaged at the time, and the wreckers would have been out there and recovered everything. And then with the advent of scuba diving, actually, you know, the much of the collection that would have been left on the seabed would have then been picked off the surface, excavated, and maybe in sort of private collections in garages or on mantelpieces.
And of course, Mark, there must be some importance to who you may speak to about funding and things like that. But I also had a very interesting talk from Hevin from Historic England. And I assume they are playing a very important role in this wreck.
Absolutely. In fact, they probably have the most important role in this. Historic England are the government's advisors on the protection and management of our heritage in England. So that would be, they are the people that tell the Minister for Culture what's worth protecting and what's not. So DCMS ministers only sign off on whether it's a listed building or a scheduled monument or a protected wreck based on advice that they receive from Historic England. So there are, I can't tell you the exact number. I think in England, I think there's somewhere around about 64 wrecks that are protected by the Protection of Wrecks Act 1973. And the London is just one of those. But one thing about Historic England is they run compile and then administer a heritage at risk register. And they've done this for many, many years now. And it's a way in which they can prioritize those assets that they have to look after that are most in need of help, resources, work, research, whatever. And back in 2019, I think there were just over 5,000 assets, heritage assets, that were deemed to be at risk in one way, shape or form, some of them being very at risk and some sort of having minor risk issues. And that risk could be associated with environmental change and degradation. It could be linked to theft, for example, maybe of, you know, for example, you know, lead or copper from roofs, etc. But of those 5,000, only 3 of them were shipwrecks. So of the over 60 heritage assets that are shipwrecks, only 3 of them are deemed to be at risk and therefore at most in need of work and support in order to make sure that they aren't destroyed and lost forever. And one of them is the London. The other two are the Rooswijk, a Dutch East Indiaman on the Goodwin Sands, and the Northumberland, an English warship again on the Goodwin Sands in Kent. The London, to me, many, you know, people will say I'm biased, I'm sure, but the London to me is the one that's really most at risk, because it's not just about sandbanks moving and shifting slowly over time with natural changes in hydrography and topology, or to do with single objects or the occasional object maybe being taken by divers. The London is being pressurized by the rapid erosion rates, unnatural erosion rates that take place in that part of the Thames, just because of its close proximity to the dredge channel. It's only one of the parts of the site is actually both parts of the sites are in the secondary channel. So vessels can go directly over the top of them. And they're very, very close, only 60 meters away from the dredge deep channel, where the largest vessels, you know, some of which could be 300 meters long and draw 14 meters of water, are coming past at 15, 16 knots. So it's the one site that really we are running out of time. And, you know, I know time team of we've got 3 days to work this site is a bit of an unrealistic, or maybe a bit of a cliche nowadays, but actually time is running out for the London. It's, you know, every day we are losing more evidence, whether that's from timbers being degraded more and eaten away more, or things washing up to the surface as the mud levels drop and washing away in the tide, literally just disappearing. And if this was on land, and this is what really gets me, if this was on land, and this is the plight that we really have to get across to listeners and to the world, if this was on land, this would not be allowed to happen this way. If we were building a new railway line, HS2, or if a new motorway was being designed to travel from east to west across the country to help with, you know, transport and communications between hubs, then actually it would be dealt with. It would be like finding a 17th century palace or high value status house with beautiful material remains, high value, low value, modern, common material, as well as rare material, organic material, human remains. It'd be like finding those in the hard shoulder and just going, you know what? We don't worry about it. We'll just leave them. We'll let the wind from the trains just destroy them and let the crows come and pick them off the surface.
There would be a 6-foot barrier around it. It would be protected. There'd be covers over it. And every day, every time one of those container vessels pass near it, it disturbs everything. And these things, I've been down to, not actually dived on the site. I leave that to your professionals. But when I was visiting, is that these things are huge. I'd never, ever seen so many and such big vessels traveling. I've seen them in ports and things like that, but I've never ever experienced the turbulence and the noise and the actual size of them, because your divers, when they go out, there's only so many times that they can be out there, and these are passing within hundreds of yards of their small little ship with a bunch of divers on.
I was exactly the same in 2016 when I first dived the site. I mean, I live in Southampton. You know, we have a container port, and I can see container ships and cruise liners from the windows of the IKEA cafe. But I've never been up close to one. I've never stood next to one or been on a boat that's 60 meters away from one when it comes past. And in 2016, I took a photograph and some video of a ship called the San Felix that was coming past whilst we were on site. And I then looked up the San Felix on the internet and found photographs of her and details about it. It was built by Daewoo Shipbuilding in 2014, and it measures 299.9 meters long, with a beam of 48 meters and a draft of 14.5. And her deadweight tonnage, in what it can carry, is 115,000 tons. It's huge.
So if it had bumped into your little paddle, your little rowing boat and things like that that you take with you, it wouldn't have felt it.
Oh, no. Well, if our rib, that's why if we go out in the rib and the dive team from the London Shipwreck Trust are out in the rib, that's why we have to communicate with the Port of London Authority to let them know that's where we are. So then they can then pass on communications to the pilots or the captains of these vessels to warn them that we are there, and that particularly that we potentially have divers in the water and therefore cannot get out of the way. It's not like a vessel that can move suddenly. You know, we cannot get out of the way because we can't jeopardize. We are the barrier. The boat is the barrier protecting that diver from being smashed up by the propellers of a ship coming past. So as a diver, you're taking on the risk of, if you get lost underwater, you cannot just come up wherever you like. Because of the risk of coming up, going south slightly and coming up and drifting into the shipping lane. So we advise the few numbers of divers that do work the site. If you get lost, if you lose your bearings, you know, you use your compass. Nobody is allowed in the water without a compass. You use your compass and you swim north for as long as you can until your air supply gets down to the reserve level. And then you come up, because at least you're swimming away from the shipping channel then. And when you're underwater, and I've had this, when you're underwater and one of these things is coming past, well, of course, you can hear it for ages. I mean, it can be a mile away and you can hear it, but you feel it as it goes past. You feel the vibrations in your chest and in your teeth as your regulator is holding your mouthpiece in place in your mouth. You can feel that vibration in your teeth. And in fact, you have to, in some ways, with the biggest ones, you actually have to hold on to something heavy on the bottom to stop yourself having to drift away because of the wash that's created, that kind of underwater wash that's created as it's coming past, even if they're slowing down. I mean, the displacement of something that size, no matter how slowly it comes past, it has a displacement wash that is felt underwater. And so it's not surprising, and it shouldn't be questioned by anybody, that this is having an impact on this site. Anybody who says, well, there's no proof that this is causing any kind of disturbance to the site, it's far enough away, I'm afraid they're in cloud cuckoo land.
Exactly. So what would you like to do about this? What is your plan A with this site?
Okay, so we'll start off with the bare minimum. The bare minimum of our aspiration is to deal with the current crisis and find the resources available. And I'm not just looking to Historic England, and I don't want to be overly critical, because they have limited budgets, limited resources that they have to spread across, of course, a whole range of heritage assets with a whole range of different risks exposed to those assets. And the numbers of shipwrecks they have to deal with, of course, is very small compared to the number of terrestrial land-based heritage assets. But they currently spend 0.7% of their budget on maritime and underwater archaeology. And we need to get that to grow, or we need to find a way of DCMS, the Department of Digital Culture, Media and Sport, getting more money from Treasury to then pass that money down to Historic England so that assets can be dealt with properly. So as a bare minimum, what we need is more resources to deal with the crisis, being able to get out on the site more, save material from destruction before it's too late, because every day we're losing the stories that we might be able to tell about, you know, not only the ship itself and the people on board, but also wider life and society in the 17th century. And if resources became available, you could deal with the site in a kind of Mary Rose style. You could put a big barge with a 4-point mooring over the site and have a professional dive team alongside volunteers working there and diving it on the tides that were available, on the slack waters that were available, with the weather windows that were available. My issue I have with that as a model, which of course, if that's the only way of doing it, I would say let's do it. But my issue with it, the flaw in that system, or that methodology, is that you have no scientific control over that excavation, because you are so exposed to the weather and the tides and the shipping. And you could have the best archaeological team of divers in the world, the most competent, experienced people there, who can be working the site as best they could, you know, on day shifts, night shifts, 24-hour windows. But you only get limited access to the site because of tides. So when the tides pick up, you might only get 45 minutes to an hour where actually a human being can stay on site there and work in those conditions.
And of course, all these divers are volunteers.
Well, at the moment, most of the divers are volunteers. So yes, outside of funded work from a grant provider, Historic England or another, then actually, all the diving that's being done right this current moment, not that with lockdown any diving's taking place, but up until now, most of the diving is being done by volunteers. The London Shipwreck Trust have a core team of three divers that dive the site, Steve Ellis, Steve Meddle, and Carol Ellis. And they are doing it on their own dime. They're paying their own costs and expenses. In partnership with them, we have launched a campaign, and we are funneling 60% of the funds towards the diving and the conservation. So, you know, we're very happy that recently we were able to raise enough money to give them £1,000 to help contribute to some of their costs. But, you know, there's three people diving the site a couple of times a month isn't going to be able to do this. We need to upscale this, and I think upscale it quite dramatically. But the reason why I can't really advocate as best possible choice the way of doing it Mary Rose style over 5 years with divers in the water when they can, is that your best diver in the world could be excavating, let's say, a leather jacket that was worn by a sailor on board, and it's in pristine condition. You would want to excavate that as slowly and as carefully as you possibly could to make sure that you didn't accidentally send it up the airlift, or put your hand through it, or your trowel through it, or, you know, rip it into two pieces when actually it could have come to the surface in one. So you'd want to do it carefully and controlled, in a controlled manner. And if your tidal window of option to dive or opportunity to dive is coming to an end, you start to rush and you start to make decisions based on, will it still be there tomorrow if I leave it now? And you start to have to make choices in your head as an individual, making those decisions as to what to do about it. And the quality of the object suffers, and there is no control there at all. So you would run the risk of the next time you could dive it. And that next time could be next day. It could be the next week. It could be a couple of weeks later because of spring tides. It's gone. You've lost it. It's disappeared. So our big vision, which you asked, which the question, the original question you asked about 10 minutes ago, the original question about the big idea was that what we've looked at as a group is we've looked at, are there other ways of doing it? And we know that back in 2007, so, you know, 13 years ago now, the Chinese came up with something that, as far as I know, had never really been done before in this particular way, where what they did was is they had their shipwreck, their historic shipwreck. In this instance, it was a silk trade route merchant trading vessel that was full of cargo from each individual merchant having their own little part of the ship's cargo hold. And, you know, an amazing collection with, I mean, I think it's somewhere in the region of estimated sort of 300,000 individual artifacts potentially on this site. So what they did was, in 30 meters of water, they actually designed a way to box out that shipwreck and to recover the entire shipwreck, as well as the sediments around it and underneath it and on top of it, and recover that to the surface in a box safely and securely, and put that box in a purpose-built facility on land, and then to excavate it under controlled conditions. So it's, and they're still excavating it now. It's 2020 and 13 years on from doing the lift. They're still excavating their box. So it means that you're not having to make judgment calls on the spur of the moment, under pressure and under stress as an individual about how to deal with an object, and having to rush the recording process as well as the excavation process. You could do it over a long period of time, maintaining environmental conditions as best as you could inside that box. And either two ways of doing it. So one is you either excavate it by just spraying it, excavating it terrestrially, like dry, but just spraying it. So imagine doing a land excavation permanently in the rain. You'd just be doing it like that. You'd be keeping it wet so that those delicate organics didn't dry out. Or why not think big here? Why not actually try to flood the box with water, maintain the water quality using standard aquarium filtration technology? And so you maintain the temperature, you maintain the pH, you maintain the salinity, you maintain the turbidity in the water, as if you had fish in it, and then have divers in there doing underwater archaeology, learning how to do underwater archaeology, you know, practicing new techniques, you know, practicing new recording techniques, new digitizing techniques, laser scanning, photogrammetry, all this kind of new technology that can be thrown at this, and use it as a showcase for engaging the general public. It's like having an aquarium and a museum, but together.
This brings in all sorts of stuff, doesn't it, Mark? Is that every time you tell me about this, a couple of images come into my mind. First of all, the famous Star Trek transportation of the whale to Montreal.
Oh, yeah.
Also, when you're talking about learning techniques underwater, this is exactly how astronauts, Apollo astronauts, the space station astronauts, learn how to work in space.
Absolutely. And I've certainly had the analogy with NASA. I'd never thought about the transporting of the whale, though, by Star Trek. That's very cool. No, that'd be great to get different analogies. And I love the fact you've come out today as a Trekkie.
It would be such a shame if some of these artifacts, which are so perfectly preserved, are lost.
Yeah, it would be such a shame. It's a real missed opportunity. I mean, ironically, actually, you could say the Mary Rose could have stayed where it is. It wasn't under any particular threat until in the 20th or the 21st, early part of the 21st century, when the Royal Navy with the aircraft carriers needed to dredge the channel in order to get a deeper water access for the aircraft carriers into Portsmouth. Up until that point, actually, the Mary Rose would have been quite safe and stable where it is. And so, you know, Alexander McKee, of course, set up Solent Ships Project in the 60s and wanted to go and find the Mary Rose. Well, actually didn't know he wanted to find the Mary Rose, just wanted to find an interesting shipwreck to excavate, to demonstrate that archaeology could take place underwater and that it was even there, because I suppose up until that point there was very little examples in the UK of preserved historic shipwrecks that were known about in the UK. But he went to find it. They found it in the 70s. And of course, they could have had no idea when they first found those two little frame ends, the two bits of wood that the very first diver saw of the Mary Rose, what potential lay on the seabed underneath them. And by having a vision and trying to create something great and special for heritage, for the country, for Portsmouth, even, you know, even arguably for the economy. I mean, the Mary Rose was the excavation in the 70s and the recovery obviously into the 80s is a great inspiration for us and a great model that we're looking at. But now we know that, you know, every museum that doesn't receive state support is a vulnerable institution, and the COVID-19 and the coronavirus sort of shutdowns and the plight of places like the Mary Rose Museum, you know, only demonstrate that to us even more. But what we're looking to them for inspiration. We're working with them collaboratively, particularly with their science and conservationist people, their team there, to advise us on best practice and good practice. And we're not looking to drain resources from them, whether it's visitors or expertise from them. Actually, what we want to do is to use this as a vehicle by which they can potentially help boost their support, to boost their funding. You know, we could use them as contractors to help run our science conservation side of things, and helping therefore to bring money into their museum and their facilities. But we really want to build, we want to take their model and say, you know, that dockyard heritage experience brings in over 100 million, well, it did anyway, brings in over £100 million a year to that local economy of Portsmouth. So, and I appreciate that's not just the Mary Rose. That's the Mary Rose, HMS Victory, HMS Warrior, the historic dockyard itself, the experience there. But over £100 million a year to a local economy of Portsmouth from a heritage asset is a big deal. And we certainly think in our wider team here at the NES and our partners, including Southend Museum Service and Southend Borough Council, is that actually putting a heritage attraction, a unique, one-of-a-kind heritage attraction like this into Southend on sea in Essex could be part of their bigger 2050 regeneration plans. Now, of course, the council at this current stage, of course, the council have got bigger problems and bigger fish to fry in terms of their resources and the concentration of their activities. But, you know, they have a 2050 vision. You know, their MP is looking for city status for Southend, and they want a cultural offering. They can't just rely on, you know, the view of the water and the pier and the amusement arcades and things to bring people to Southend. A cultural offering to rival the Tate in Margate, or to rival Brighton Pavilion and, you know, what Brighton has and the Blackpools, etc., for tourism. Now, you know, we might all be traveling a lot less as a result of this, but I really don't believe that we're all going to stop seeing the country or seeing the world as part of our, you know, sort of leisure time. I can't believe that's going to be the future, that we're going to stop that.
And the government is talking is that people are probably next year still going to be holidaying at home. And having my first visit to Southend was my last trip out, actually. But
yes, how was it?
For various reasons. But yes, I think something like this, because people don't realize what is on their doorstep. And I think it would be an asset to Southend, to be quite honest, and hopefully, Mark, you'll get your Christmas wish.
Well, yeah, maybe not this Christmas, but maybe in Christmases to come. I think, you know, the fact you know it becoming an asset is really important here. We need to, at the moment, it's called, the shipwreck itself is called, it's termed, you know, by Historic England, it's termed as a heritage asset. I would argue that currently, actually, we're leaving it where it is, it's actually a heritage burden. We haven't released it to become an asset yet. It can't be an asset where it is. It becomes an asset when you recover either the material and put it on display, and you build exhibitions around it and the educational experiences, both face-to-face and online, and you take it out to schools and you take it out around the country to, you know, traveling on loan exhibitions, etc. or you really, really maximize that asset and you recover the entire thing and you go big and you really think phenomenal about this. And it's interesting if we look at the socio sort of economics and the socio politics around this. And I was probably too young to have really considered the way in which, by all accounts, the Thatcher government used the raising of the Mary Rose for its own political propaganda, in terms of, you know, bringing the country together, you know, galvanizing the nation, you know, really sort of milking the royal connection and Prince Charles's connection to that to raise, you know, the government, not the government, the nation's warm, you know, to bring a warmth to the nation's heart, that the fact that we could do this, we could pull this off and create something incredibly special that still, you know, has a is now part of, as far as at least I understand it, it's part of the sort of the national curriculum and in whatever age group it is that for the Mary Rose. Why not look to that and think of that in a similar way now in the 21st century with the London? And of all the shipwrecks we have, I would find me somebody who can think of one that's in more desperate need than this one. I think you'd struggle to find a site that needs it more.
Thank you, Mark. And as I said, I hope you get your Christmas list, wish list. And thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you, Mark. That was excellent. Really enjoyed it. One slight correction. After the interview, Mark emailed me to say that it's the Turner in Margate, not the Tate. Yeah, I think he makes a reference about 32 minutes into the interview. If you'd like to find out more about the work of the Nautical Archaeology Society, look for www.nauticalarchaeologysociety.org. That's all one word, nauticalarchaeologysociety.org, where you'll also find links to the Save the London campaign. Other places to look, there's the diver that's regularly diving the wreck. His name is Stephen Ellis. You can find him on Twitter. He's at Stephen, that's Stephen with a V, at Stephen Ellis 3 on Twitter. He also has a website, thelondonwreckproject.co.uk. There's another Twitter feed called simply at Save the London, another place where you can find out about the London wreck, 1665 there as well. To find out more about SUT, go to www.sut.org. To contact me, it's steve.hall@sut.org. Please don't forget to rate, review and subscribe to our podcast. Thank you to Sue John for doing the interview this week and to Emily Boddy for the podcast artwork and podcast music. More from us soon. Keep in touch, stay healthy, and if you're in somewhere nice and sunny, enjoy the good weather. Bye for now.